And then he moves on for the reason of the incarnation. He says, why all the fuss to maintain these precisely calibrated tensions? Why not just, you know, it's God in human form, and, you know, we don't really care about what happens after that. Why does things like the hypostatic union matter? Big words, it seems like, oh, a mixture of natures or separation, but 100% or fully versus half and half. Why does all this matter? Well, because the precise and unparalleled dynamic that encompasses the identity of Christ are critical to the work of Christ. Redeeming a wretched world requires a special redeemer. Exactly. Such a unique redeemer would need to be free from the stain of sin that affects every other human creature in order to offer himself to God as an acceptable propitiation, as atoning sacrifice to sin. Find that in Hebrews 2 and 1 Peter 1. And so this uniqueness where he has to have kind of a human nature, but it also seems like the Bible says if you have a human nature, it is impossible to fully carry out. Yeah. You have to be almost godlike in order to carry out the law.
Yeah.
So how do we do it?
Yeah.
The incarnation.
That's right. So he has the human nature, and yet he's without sin.
Right.
Right. So that's the uniqueness of Christ, and thus all mankind, without exception, falls under divine, retributive,
right,
condemnation. Right. God's retribution. But God, in His unexpected, extraordinary grace and electing freedom, may choose to pardon some of the ill-deserving sinners, right? That's what Ephesians 1 talks about, by diverting their just punishment to the uniquely suited God-man, whose penal substitutionary death effectively secures the expiation. Boy, he's really getting into it, right? That means the removal, to expiate, to remove their guilt while meeting his own righteous demand. So God uses Christ, right, the God-man, as our substitution, mm-hmm, so that our guilt and sin would be removed. That's what he's attempting to say here, right? Or at least that's what he is saying, and I'm attempting to repeat it.
Right. theology words all the way down.
That's right. Yeah, so he tells us that if that substitute were himself stained by sin, and this is the point we were making earlier, right, if Jesus was just a human, if he was stained by sin, then his death would fail as an atonement, right?
Right.
It would be nothing more, he tells us, than the just recompense of his own rebellion, right?
Right. So how does he pay? How does he live a perfect life? And then how does he pay for everyone? So it needs to be this both. It's a yes and type answer here. So the reconciliation of sinners to a holy God could happen no other way except through both the humble incarnation of the Son of God and the high cost involved in his bloody atonement. In John 14 and Acts 4 says this, the incarnation and atonement are inseparably linked. It needs to be both here. The human blood of the incarnate second person of the Trinity had to be spilled. God in his immaterial being has no circulatory system, no heart, no arteries, no veins, and no blood. For God to shed blood, he had to become man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a quote that he pulls here. I wrote, wow, exclamation mark, twice in this chapter. And so yeah. I have to read this. So he's quoting the nihilist Albert Camus, who I've read some of his stuff before. And he comes from this philosophy. One of his most well-known one is without meaning in the universe, because, you know, there's nothing outside of us. There's only what we bring to the table, and I can't even be sure about you. So if all life is pain, you're welcome. I know my mind. I don't know other minds. So since all life is pain, is it moral? Is it the correct response to kind of kill yourself? And that's kind of the question,
right?
He brings in, well, if there's no meaning out there, then we can generate.
He says suicide is really the first and only serious question in philosophy.
Yeah.
That's what he says, right?
And Camus is kind of known for pithy things, but if you read kind of his larger things, you kind of get bogged down in a in a what type nature. But he says this, and I really am going to read this entire quote that he provides, because so this is a nihilist. This is an unbeliever. This is someone who hears this message and rejects it. So he says, in that Christ has suffered and had suffered voluntarily, suffering was no longer unjust, and all pain was necessary. In one sense, Christianity's bitter intuition and legitimate pessimism concerning human behavior is based on the assumption that overall injustice is as satisfying to man as total justice. Only the sacrifice of an innocent God could justify the endless and universal torture of innocence. Only the most abject suffering by God and the assuage man's agony. If everything, without exception, in heaven and earth is doomed to pain and suffering, then a strange form of happiness is possible. So this is, again, an unbeliever who is probably writing way better on why the incarnation has to happen and what that means and what it requires than I'll put myself on the chopping block than anything that I could come up with. And he does just really, really well on pulling this quote. He must have, Christensen must have had this in his back pocket to post it up on his board with the yarn on it to bring this chapter together.